Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with Professor Alan Taylor, University of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson Foundation Professor. His new book, American Civil Wars, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. The three states of North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. We've looked at the gathering storm in the United States, leading to the battles that were massacres from 1861 till 1865. We've looked at the revolution, so-called, which was really two sides butchering each other in Mexico over concepts of individual rights and freedom and liberty. Now we look at Canada, because one person manages to tell the story with his life. Born 1815 in Glasgow, Scotland, John A. MacDonald. Professor, reading your presentation of MacDonald made me smile. Is that an appropriate response?
Well, he made people smile in his own time. He was a great storyteller, very gregarious, one of the epic drinkers in North American history. And a consummate politician of the old school, able to make deals with anybody. So there was this great anecdote which was told that an opposition member and John A. MacDonald were deep in their cups and hugging each other and drinking. And the opposition member said to John A. MacDonald, "How I love you, John A., how I wish I could trust you."
Father was gregarious, as John A. was, but not especially successful. His mother was ambitious. Yeah. How striking it is that ambitious mothers lead to great statesmen. Very striking. I see this again and again.
Well, you see it with Lincoln. Lincoln was much closer to his mother than he was to his father.
And MacArthur. Yeah. I was thinking of Douglas MacArthur in the 20th century. His mother moved to live outside of West Point while he was there. She was keen to maintain their relationship. They moved to Kingston, Ontario, and he was ambitious enough. I don't think he went to college, but he became a lawyer when he was 20 years old. But he liked a good time. You tell the story of a dead horse in a Methodist church. I didn't quite understand that one.
Well, like a lot of young, ambitious men with some intellect, he was attracted to ideas that challenged conventional Christian ideas. And so as a prank, they just hauled a dead horse into a Methodist church.
And he defended the young men.
Somebody else who was accused. And so he had some inside information because MacDonald had been involved in the whole thing. MacDonald was, he was a lawyer. As well as a politician. And that combination is very widespread in both the United States and Canada, but also in Mexico. So we look at the great leaders of all three of these polities, MacDonald, Lincoln, Benito Juarez, who we haven't covered quite yet, or Ocampo. They're all lawyers. So this is an age of opportunity if you were a lawyer. It's an age of expanding litigation and expanding legislation. And both of these are linked to the growing complexity of modern economies and modern transportation networks that generated new disputes.
Canada at this time doesn't look like the map we have now. The in-between part is indistinct. And the migrants are coming to the United States via Canada in some instances. As I remember reading one time, Alan, the passage was not as expensive going to Canada as it was to the U.S. I don't remember the details, but there was a period of time where it was economical to go to Canada and then sort of make your way south.
Well, during the 1820s and 1830s, the British government subsidized emigration to Canada. So if you're a poor person and you were in Ireland or you were in Scotland, your opportunity would be to ship out and go to Quebec. Now, for many of these people, ultimately, they want to go to the United States where the economy is booming. So that does happen. But once Britain lifted those subsidies, it's actually cheaper to go to New York City, and then immigration is much more via New York City than before.
John A. MacDonald also had the good luck to being a Scotsman.
Yeah.
And that was a part of the Canadian migration that dominated. You mentioned the three great universities, McGill in Montreal, Dalhousie in Halifax, and the University of Toronto in Toronto, all founded by Scotsmen. And that gave him an advantage for politics, is that, or law, or both?
Well, all. You know, the better educated people in Canada tended to be of Scots or Scots descent. And they supported each other. So if you were a merchant or you were a newspaper publisher or you were a lawyer or you were founding a railroad or you wanted to found a university, then you helped other Scots band together to do those things. So the governing class in Canada of that time, outside of Quebec, which was Francophone, but outside of Quebec, the dominant political element were Scots, and that helped John A. MacDonald get ahead.
He joins Parliament in 1844, and he has a talent. He can remember names, all names, and he also dresses very well. He's dapper. Mm-hmm. I love the story of how they chose Ottawa to be the capital. Tell that story, Professor.
Well, at the time, the capital, I should just back up and say that Canada, as you indicated, is much smaller. It wasn't really a country yet. It's still part of the British Empire. But two of the colonies of that British Empire, what is now Quebec and what is now Ontario, were united in a federation. Now, that federation had autonomy for domestic affairs, but is still overall governed by the British Empire and protected by the British Empire. But the colony of what is now Quebec, was then called Lower Canada, mostly Francophone, mostly Catholic. Upper Canada's mostly Protestant and mostly Scots descended. And the two parts don't work very well together. Though John A. MacDonald is the leading politician that is trying to promote cooperation and plays a major part in holding these two colonies together in this federation. But one of the great challenges, where the capital going to be? The leading cities were both in Quebec, Montreal and Quebec City. Toronto's kind of a third place, and Kingston's a fourth place. So the capital had bounced around between these four places from year to year. And MacDonald realizes you need one capital, and he's thinking somewhere right along the border between these two colonies. And the border was the Ottawa River, and there was a lumber town called Ottawa. But he knew that this would be unpopular with everybody. So he managed to engineer it that the decision would be turned over to Queen Victoria, the monarch of Britain, and she would decide. And then MacDonald and his other friends fed the information to the Queen, who'd never been to Canada, never would go to Canada, that Ottawa should be the selection. So she selected Ottawa, and there was a lot of grumbling, and for a brief while, MacDonald's government was pushed out of power over all of this, but ultimately, Ottawa stayed the choice and is the capital of Canada today.
Because both sides disliked it? Did they talk about that?
Yeah, both. Everybody disliked Ottawa at that time. It was a shabby little lumber town, and so nobody was particularly happy about it. But it seemed like it's better than to continue to fight about it.
A detail about John A. MacDonald is his friend McGee. And mm-hmm. I had not known that MacDonald had an alcohol problem, and so did McGee. Now, was that irregular at the time so much that they would comment on it?
Well, I would say that it's alcohol consumption was much higher in the mid-19th century in both Canada and the United States than it is today. And among leading men, you'd be hard-pressed to find many leaders who who did not consume a great deal of alcohol. Though I'll put an asterisk on that, there was a growing temperance movement, and Abraham Lincoln, for example, almost never drank. But John A. MacDonald's heavy drinking is all too characteristic of the age, and his boon companion is an Irish-born politician, Thomas D'Arcy McGee. And they are both bon vivants, and they love a good story, and they hang out with each other. And other politicians thought, okay, heavy drinking's the norm, but what you two guys are doing is over the top. Because there would be periods of time where neither of them were capable of attending sessions of parliament because of their hangovers. And so at one point, the cabinet said, at least one of you has got to stop drinking. And so MacDonald said to Thomas D'Arcy McGee, I'm not going to stop, so you better stop. But McGee was not having any of it, so it didn't change the behavior of either of them.
Another recommendation for MacDonald is his negotiation with the Crown over these years. However, there is a dark chapter here. Slavery never was a challenge to Canada, but their treatment of Native Americans as they consolidated the continent, similar to what we met in Minnesota. So I guess there was a uniformity whether they were in the U.S. or Canada. They treated the Native Americans as pests to be exterminated or tolerated. Was MacDonald that way?
Well, I would qualify that a bit. I would say the predominant Canadian policy is to try to kill Native culture through kindness, sort of kindness, which is in most of Canada, there were not the brutal wars that characterized the United States against Native peoples. Now, the one great exception, which I talk about in the book, is in British Columbia, where the miners there did do their best to exterminate local Native people so that the miners could control the rivers and harvest gold from them. Those miners were Americans who had moved in there and were out of the control of any government. So the general Canadian policy has a partial similarity with the United States in that both of these countries were committed to the proposition that Native cultures were inferior and they needed to be ended through obliging Native people to send their children to schools where they would be educated in Protestant values and in the values of white Americans or white Canadians. And so John A. MacDonald is very much on board with that, but he's not a cheerleader for the kind of brutal violence that occurred in British Columbia, which he had no part in.
The book is American Civil Wars. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Alan Taylor of the University of Virginia. His new book is American Civil Wars, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. The war between the states, ongoing battles sweeping across the landscape. And the professor is very clear about those battles and the preponderance of victories towards the Union armies as they brought into account their overwhelming numbers and their ability to generate the tools of war, cannon and rifles and horses. And the Confederate leadership in and around Richmond, not able to counter the weight of the logistics of the North. In addition, the battles were fought, generally speaking, in Virginia and Pennsylvania, so that the Union was always an aggressor, especially when Grant became president. We're not going to spend time there. We're going to go to the war is over, 1865. And I remember a scene, Professor, I don't know, it must have been a newspaper, about traveling over Virginia between Washington and Appomattox Courthouse. And the dogs and the buzzards were everywhere from the dead bodies left out. The professor oft times mentioning the horror of the battles. No glory whatsoever. Horror. However, at this point, I wanted to make a dart to Mexico again because there's that Mexican massacre is going on at the same time. And the president is Juarez, and he's in flight for 4 years. Do I remember that correctly? Running from the aggressor out of Mexico City.
Well, it's 3 years.
Three years.
But, you know, you've got the president of the legitimate government of Mexico, the Republic of Mexico, is Benito Juarez. By this point, Ocampo is dead. He'd been killed by conservative guerrillas. Juarez is, and a handful of supporters are pushed all the way to the vicinity of El Paso, Texas. That's how small his foothold had become in his own country, replaced by a monarchy supported by French troops of the French Emperor Napoleon III. That monarch in Mexico is Maximilian. So at that point in time, when that point in time being 1865, it looks like the imperialists of Maximilian and Napoleon III have defeated Benito Juarez. But Juarez is so committed to his cause as the cause of law and of justice, and he has such formidable dignity and power of will and intellect that he will eventually build up a sufficient force to overcome this invasion and occupation of Mexico.
And the U.S. position at this point, who they choose to deal with, Mexico City or Juarez?
Well, during the American Civil War, it's the existence of that civil war that enables Napoleon III to send in military forces to support the conservatives and to install Maximilian as the emperor in Mexico City. Once the American Civil War is over, then all bets will be off. But during the Civil War, the Union government, led by Lincoln, with his Secretary of State, William Seward, recognize the reality that they can't fight France too. They can't send troops into Mexico. They got their hands full fighting the Confederacy. So long as the Confederacy is tying up Union forces, there will be no American intervention against the French intervention. But what happens when the Confederacy is defeated? Lee's army surrenders, the Confederate government collapses, and the Union is restored. Well, then General Grant, the great leader of Union forces, wants to intervene directly in Mexico by sending in U.S. troops. But Seward and Lincoln's successor as president, Andrew Johnson, overrule him. And instead, what the United States will do is to covertly send in munitions to support Juarez's forces. And those munitions will be sufficient for Juarez to build up his forces and to sweep Maximilian out of power.
We need to turn to Andrew Johnson, Professor. Alan Taylor is the author. American Civil Wars is the book. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Alan Taylor, the University of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson Foundation Professor of History. His new book is American Civil Wars, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. It is after the war. The horror is ended, but it hasn't. And that is the confounding detail of what is generally understood as Reconstruction, which sounds a benign word, but massed murder, routine murder, a word we have in the 21st century conveys it, lynching. It was commonplace. Throughout the South, the Confederates going home were viciously resentful of what had happened. And some of their generals took charge. We know them now as the Klan or the White Privilege or the White League. They took charge of ex-Confederates, and they believed that they were conveying the authority of the government as they brutalized the freed slaves. And the U.S. government at the time had very little to do to stopping this. The professor provides the statistic that in April of 65, there were 202,000 Union troops in the Confederacy. In 1866, There were 18,000. So we're talking about a dramatic demobilization. But it all turns on Andrew Johnson, former senator from Tennessee, whom Abraham Lincoln chose to be his vice president in the election of 64 as a man who could fuse the two parts of the country together. Once in office, though, with Lincoln dead, well, they knew him, Professor, as an alcoholic copperhead. What did they mean when they called him that?
Well, a copperhead was a term of abuse applied by unionists toward Democratic politicians and voters who seemed to favor the South during the Civil War. Now, in fact, Andrew Johnson was not a copperhead during the war. He was very much against the Confederacy. But once he became president, his great challenge is, how can he get himself reelected? And he knew that he was a lifelong Democrat from Tennessee, and Lincoln had put him on the ticket in order to appeal to Democrats. So Douglas doesn't feel comfortable with Republicans, and Republican politicians in Congress don't feel comfortable with him. So Johnson's not sure that he's going to get the Republican Party nomination in 1868. So he's starting to angle to rebuild the Democratic Party, and he reaches out to the South, and he starts to become somebody who is the best friend of former Confederates. He pardons them. He helps them get back into power in their states, and he is counting on them then to nominate him for the reelection as president as a Democratic candidate in 1868. And so that helps to explain most of his behavior. The other part of it is that he was a virulent racist. He distrusted, disliked African Americans, did not want to have them have any civil rights, including the vote. And so he is then pitted in conflict against a overwhelming Republican majority in Congress that regards him as having turned about and become pro-Confederate after the war was over.
Of the 15,000 names identified as landowners and slave keepers who were not to be trusted giving back their franchise, Johnson pardoned 13,500, and there were rumors that he took money for it. However, at the same time, he forced the prosecution of the assassins of Abraham Lincoln, driving that story so that it's very difficult today to solve all of the intrigue of the plot against Lincoln and the plot against the U.S. government at the time. Johnson was a man on the defensive and in a hurry. However, I took this note, Professor, because it seemed to me, again, illustrating the contradictions of the time. Connecticut, Minnesota, and Wisconsin passed laws preventing freedmen from voting. Did I write that down correctly?
Well, they had laws already on the books. So during the Civil War, on Northern blacks, there were free blacks in the North. They were a relatively small population. But outside of the New England states, they couldn't vote. A few could qualify by a special property qualification in New York. But in the broad stretch of the rest of the country in the North, there were laws against blacks voting. And there were referendums periodically to say, well, let's actually open the vote up to black men. Nobody was talking about opening it up to black women or to white women at that time. And in those referendums, they almost always lost. And so Johnson is able to exploit this apparent hypocrisy by saying to Northern congressmen, you're trying to force me to force on the Southern states. They're opening up the vote to black men, but you won't do it in your own state of Ohio. So what makes that right? So Johnson had a certain immoral consistency in promoting keeping blacks everywhere away from the vote, whereas most Northern Republicans were inconsistent at that time. But that recognition of that inconsistency actually led to most Northern states coming around to support the vote for blacks in their states, as well as the South, as we get to the end of the 1860s.
And there was, we go through the impeachment, the final vote in May, not removing him from office. racing off to, I believe, Cincinnati for the convention. Grant would be nominated to be president of the United States in the 68 election. At the time, and I'm not sure I read this consistently, there was still the argument, was that war for the Union or was that war for freeing the slaves? Was that argument still going on in 68?
Yeah, I mean, it's still going on in the sense that in late 1862, Lincoln and most Republicans had come around to the conviction that to save the Union, they needed to end slavery. Their priority was always to save the Union. A military victory required smashing the economy of the South and recruiting black troops. Once you reach that conclusion, then you have to add as a secondary goal of the war effort to emancipate the slaves within the Confederacy. And then in early 1865, they get a constitutional amendment, which would ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But once the Reconstruction becomes violently contested in the South, it is testing the will of Northern politicians. Are they willing to continue this military occupation and supervision of the Southern states in order to protect the new civil rights of blacks? Or were they going to decide that they would reconcile with the South on terms that kept slavery at an end, but which allowed the segregation and the disenfranchisement of new black citizens in the South? That becomes the choice by the middle of the 1870s. And Northern politicians overwhelmingly decided for the latter, which is to say the war had been about the Union. We've restored the Union. The Confederates accept that they are part of the Union permanently. They accept that slavery is at an end, and so we're going to leave the whole question of black people and their rights to Southern states to solve if they want to.
And here come the black coats. What were those, Professor?
Well, the first black coats were actually introduced in 1865. Andrew Johnson allowed this to happen. The newly reconstructed Southern governments imposed these very strict restrictions on the rights of blacks and basically compelled them to remain agricultural laborers. They couldn't be bought and sold anymore. They weren't supposed to be whipped anymore. So they weren't technically slaves, but they were held in a kind of serfdom under these black coats. Well, the Republican Congress said we're appalled by this. And so they start to move against Johnson, and they are able to end these Confederate, neo-Confederate governments that were established immediately after the Civil War, and to impose a military-guided reconstruction of the South until the middle of the 1870s, when they back off from that, allow Southern whites to restore their domination, and after that, they bring back versions of the Black Codes.
And the Black Codes remain, for the balance of the century, they come to be known as Jim Crow, but that beyond the scope of the professor's conversation this time. We're going to turn to other aspects of ironic inconsistencies, the Native Americans, the Chinese, and the Canadians. This is Alan Taylor's American Civil Wars, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Alan Taylor of the University of Virginia. His new book, American Civil Wars, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. The West was not outside of the war fighting during 1861 to 1865, but following the war, the West became a battle zone over many decades. We begin with the Bozeman Trail, where the Native Americans, gathering around a chief named Red Cloud, drove out the encroachment, the forts of the U.S. Army. However, that would be the beginning of the tale, not the end of it. Again, Professor, I've come to the irony that a nation that tore itself in pieces over slavery did not see the way it was treating Native Americans to be worse than slaves. In fact, there was Indian slavery, and they tried to stop it and couldn't in the new territories. Was that a debate? Were there McManuses or Swiss Helms about brutalizing Native Americans in any of the editorial pages?
Well, there are two positions that are held in the United States toward Native peoples, and neither of them would be what we would consider a modern, humane approach. Leaving Native peoples alone with their own cultures was not considered acceptable by almost anyone in political authority. So the choice is you exterminate them. That's one option, and that was pretty popular, particularly with many settlers in the West. The second position, which is the dominant one, held by and dominant in the federal government, is the greatest kindness you could do to Native peoples would be to restrict them on reservations, disarm them, and force them to give up their culture, force them to become American citizens, and incorporate them into the United States so that Native peoples would continue to exist, but not as Native peoples, but just as other Americans, just as Irish Americans had moved here or German Americans, that it just would be one big country with certain ethnicities, but equal rights for all, and they would be individuals. Well, this is not acceptable to most Native peoples. They don't want to just be individual American citizens. They want to preserve their culture. They want to preserve their language. They want to preserve their own governance. And that was just considered unacceptable by Americans. And so they used military power to force Native peoples onto reservations and to force them to submit their children to these re-education programs, often at pretty grim boarding schools.
It is difficult also to read about Grant and Sheridan. Sheridan, the great cavalry officer who rode in the valley, the Shenandoah Valley, reversing defeats in 64, became part of Lincoln's re-election campaign. But Grant used him, Grant in the White House, as chief of the army and also enforcer out west against the Native American population. And Sheridan was brutal towards them, so he held two things in his mind. He had been a principal freeing the slaves, but he was the heavy hand of authority when it came to brutalizing the Native Americans. And I guess that's the position they all held. They didn't see that inconsistency.
No, they didn't see an inconsistency because they are committed to the liberalism of the 19th century. And the liberalism of the 19th century said the best society is one that's composed of equal individuals. And there aren't these corporate groups like Native American tribes that have some sort of distinctive state in society. So the drive is to just eliminate things like seceding Southern states or Native American tribes, and just to create this uniform landscape of uniform equal rights. And, you know, that sound, in a way, it sounds nice, but if what you're doing is you're forcing people to give up a culture, a language, a way of life that's been very dear to them, and you're doing so by military force, you're suppressing their religious practices, you're suppressing the expression of their own language, that is, and frankly, a great cruelty. But they didn't recognize that because they thought being an American citizen was the best thing in the world. So why wouldn't everybody want it? And if you resisted it and you were a weaker people, you should be subjected to military force in order to compel you to be American citizens. That was the thinking of the time. And so that's how Sheridan thought. That's how Grant thought. They had come to shed their most of their racism toward Black Americans. But Black Americans wanted that vision of being equal individual citizens in the United States. Native peoples didn't.
Between 1840 and 1880, I think I have my note correct, 300,000 Chinese workers came to America to work on the railroad and other projects out west. They were denied citizenship. What was the thinking?
Well, the Chinese are a great challenge to American racial thinking because American racial thinking tended to treat minorities as lazy. And it's a great distortion because there were fewer people that had to work hard as African Americans at that time just to survive. But that was the thinking. Well, you got with the Chinese who were technically free, they're not held in slavery, though some of them arrived as indentured servants. And they're extremely communal and cooperating with each other and working extremely hard and saving their money. And they are in many communities in the West, such as San Francisco, conspicuous by their success at being entrepreneurs in small businesses. And this is something that infuriates a significant number of Western white men who feel that there's something unfair about the ways in which the Chinese would cooperate with each other to get ahead economically and to defy the racial thinking of the time, which said that white Americans were superior. And so white Americans in the West start to elect governments, legislators and congressmen and governors who would be committed to denying citizenship to the Chinese, and by the end of the 19th century to restrict any further immigration from China into the United States.
To begin at the ending, we go back to Jane McManus, who's known as the anti-abolitionist in her youth, who after she loses her husband, after mm-hmm. that she founds black education schools in the West Indies mm-hmm. and becomes what she wrote against in her younger life. Was that commonplace, Professor?
Well, I wouldn't say that most people make as radical a change as she did, but it's not unknown. I also the example of Joseph Shelby, who had been a very active in the burning of the anti-slavery town of Lawrence, Kansas in the 1850s and had become a very successful Confederate general. After the Civil War, he comes to accept black equality, and he even pushes for the erection of a statue to honor John Brown, who had been his great enemy during the 1850s and called John Brown the greatest man of the age. So it is possible for people to rethink core convictions. And Jane McManus Casno rethought her racist convictions, and by the end of her life is committed to doing everything she could to help people of African descent in the Caribbean and the United States to achieve better educations.
The book is American Civil Wars, So Many Stories. Wonderful. Alan Taylor is the author, A Continental History, 1850 to 1873. I'm John Batchelor.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.